This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. British voters will head to the polls in a snap election on June 8th that was called by Prime Minister Theresa May in April. May's position in the polls was looking shaky in light of Labour Party progressive Jeremy Corbyn's inroads, until the brutal attack in Manchester outside a youth concert that left 22 people dead, including an 8-year-old girl and the parents of young concertgoers. Terrorist attacks like Manchester tend to boost incumbents and conservatives, and Prime Minister May's position may be bolstered. Meanwhile, US-UK relations are tense after the name of the suspected Manchester bomber and photos of evidence were leaked to the US media. British police have announced that they have stopped sharing intelligence with the US, and President Donald Trump has said he will ask the Justice Department to investigate the leaks. Trump is in Brussels meeting with NATO officials this week. My guest is Samir Dosani. He's an independent activist and freelance journalist. Welcome to the program, Samir.
Hi, Sonali.
So let's first talk about the attack itself before we get into the elections and the impact that the attack might have had on the elections. This is an ongoing issue facing European countries that, you know, we've seen major cities in Europe become targets of these types of bombings. In this particular case, the Islamic State took credit. However, the suspected bomber was a Manchester-born person of, I believe, Libyan origin. A man named Salman Abedi is being seen as a suspect. Does the attack in Manchester, the bombing, follow a pattern that these European attacks, like the ones we've seen in Brussels and Paris, etc., that we've seen before?
I mean, I think the short answer is we don't know, to be completely honest. But yes, on the face of it, it looks likely. It looks like this is a young person who was growing up in a fairly conservative environment. Apparently, the Libyan community in Manchester is very tight and sort of keeps in very close touch. And he was attending what are known to be relatively mainstream churches, mainstream mosques. So it's not like he was being radicalized in Britain. But he also had a lot of ties to, most likely, this is all conjecture, I should say, because not all the details have come out. But most likely his father is in Libya now, and he just came back from Libya, I think 3 weeks ago, though I don't know the exact date. So he's someone who spends a lot of time in Libya. He's someone who was, you know, kind of quiet, taciturn kind of kid, adolescent, is how his friends described him. All his friends were kind of shocked. All his friends in Manchester were shocked to hear that it was him, except for one or two who mentioned stories about him getting upset when the imams in the masjid would talk about the need for nonviolence, the need to not to condemn those who murder in the name of Islam and so on. So apparently one friend heard him take offense with that statement, and that friend was not surprised. But almost everyone else who came into contact with this person was quite surprised. So on the face of it, it looks like it does follow a certain pattern. Someone who has ties to the diaspora, but also someone who has ties to the home country, you know, getting radicalized. I should also say this is happening in an environment, not so much in Manchester, but in Libya itself, where the rule of law and order has been totally destroyed by the NATO removal of Muammar Gaddafi a few years ago. So it's in that context that these extremist groups are coming up. You remember that before we talked about ISIS, we used to talk about ISIL, that's the Islamic State in Libya. So these are extremist groups that are strong in Libya now and in control of part of the country.
So when we have the sort of standard reaction to such attacks here in the West, there is a sense of bewilderment about, I just don't understand how or why these attacks continue to happen. And of course, politicians tend to take advantage of these attacks seeming to come out of nowhere. But as you just mentioned, there is a broad context here. In the case of Manchester, when you have such a large number of people being killed, it's tempting to try to talk about unity and solidarity without still addressing the political context. Is that what is happening in Manchester and broadly speaking in UK and the Europe right now, that ordinary Europeans, ordinary British people are not really seeing what's happening to them, be connected to their government's policies in countries like Libya?
Yeah, listen, I think the US, the UK in 2017 is not the same as the US in 2001 or 2002, right? So I think that the kind of struggles that people of our generation, Sonali, had to do as young activists 15 years ago, where we really were operating in the dark, there wasn't any sense of connection with US foreign policy, and we had to sort of make those cases from zero. I don't think that's the world we're living in right now. And I think that rather things are quite divided, and almost scarily so. I mean, I think that there are people who know, I think it's hard to deny this sort of conflict, breeding conflict and cycles of violence that exist. But there are people who just see it as it has to continue, and we have to get rid of those people, whoever those people are. And I would say this on both sides. There are Islamists, there are jihadists, there are Wahhabis who just see their mission as sort of taking over everything in a kind of amorphous way, or causing so much havoc, as exactly happened in Libya, that then they end up in control. Right? That's sort of their modus operandi. At the same side, you have people, maybe supporters of Trump. Theresa May, to her credit, hasn't said anything like this yet. If she says it, it might be a mistake, because I think there may be more people in the other camp in the UK than in this camp. But people who basically say, no, we have to really take the fight to these guys. We have to sort of bomb more countries. We have to continue this, etc. So I think we're now entering a period, you know, to use another UK analogy, the war with the IRA, between the last phase of the war between Irish separatists and the UK lasted from, say, the early 70s until the late 90s. And that over that 15, 20 year period, you got to a point where people just got sick of the cycle of violence and were ready to compromise. And I get the feeling that in the UK, that's sort of where we may be going. And I was heartened to see things like, you know, anti-Islamophobia rhetoric from officials in Britain, not just from activists. People saying, you know, don't just use this as an excuse to target a whole community. Let's talk about law and order. Let's talk about justice. Let's also talk about, hey, let's even talk about our foreign policy. I've even heard some of those voices in Britain. So I think it's there's still more scope for having that discussion than there was 15 years ago.
But these sorts of attacks do still tend to favor conservatives, don't they? It's so much easier for conservatives to take advantage of such attacks, because when you have such a horrific attack with such a terrible death toll, young people being targeted, it's very easy to say, let's fight back. You know, we won't stand for this. We're going to take revenge. We're going to increase security. We're going to not back down, because you want to appear tough in the face of what, you know, essentially horrific bullying that these terrorist acts are. So how do you see this particular Manchester bombing impacting the election? Even if Theresa May hasn't come out and said anything overtly, she's the one who called these snap elections to bolster her position on Brexit, to get a bigger popular mandate to carry out the divorce from the EU, if you will. And in the lead up to the Manchester bombing, Jeremy Corbyn, the Progressive Labour Party politician, was gaining in popularity. Now, are things different after Manchester?
Yeah, again, the short answer is it's too early to tell. There haven't been any polls conducted in the last couple of days, and there's no campaigning allowed until tomorrow, until Friday. The British are actually quite more sensible when it comes to those kind of things, policy-wise, than the US. So we won't know until for some days to come. But yeah, my instinct is the same as yours, Sonali, that this will... So I should just clarify, it's not that Theresa May was looking... It's not like the Tories, which are led by the current Prime Minister, Theresa May, it's not that they were looking like they were going to lose the election. Rather, what was looking like possible was that they might actually have fewer seats than they have now. They already have a majority, but they don't have a big enough majority to push through some of the policies they want to push through related to Brexit and related to, by the way, destroying social services. So it's not just about Brexit, it's about It's about some tax cuts for the rich are being proposed, and some social services cuts, especially the NHS is on the chopping block.
Right. Didn't Theresa May try to raise, basically cutting benefits for the elderly, which, was obviously not very well received?
That's exactly right. That was just a couple of days ago, and she had to walk it back for the disabled and the elderly. She had to walk that back almost immediately, and she ended up looking very, very foolish. In fact, every time she opened her mouth in the last few weeks until this Manchester incident, it felt like you could sort of feel the poll numbers dropping for the Tories, because she started in a very strong position. The election was held the day that she called the election. They would have got a much, much bigger majority. But as we move closer to the election, Britain also has certain rules about fairness between the political candidates. So the kind of mud raking that was going on towards the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, actually you find that that's much less as we get closer to the election, because they have to give equal airtime, et cetera. So that was also helping Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. And Theresa May was kind of making a fool of herself every time she opened her mouth. This joke about strong and stable was becoming a bit of a, she would say these buzz phrases every time she went to the podium, and it was beginning to look foolish. What's happened now is that not only is Theresa May the prime minister, she's the former home minister. So she was in charge of security. Now, in my book, if there was any sense in the world, that would actually be a strike against her, right? Because whatever this is, whoever takes the blame for this, it happened on her watch, right? It happened, and she has no excuse. She was the home minister before, she was in charge of domestic security. And as these threads start to unravel, it seems pretty clear that there was some kind of network going on. There are organizations that are suspected of being involved. ISIS has claimed credit, but everyone thinks that's a bit of a joke. ISIS will claim credit for almost anything. So when you put it all together, it looks like this is something that could have, should have been anticipated. And I think that should actually fall out against the Tories. But knowing how these things work, as you say, right-wing politicians, fear-mongers tend to do a lot better in the wake of these kind of things, which is really tragic, because of course that just feeds the cycle of violence even further.
Right, and she's comfortable in that position, talking about things like national security. This is where she has some confidence. What about Jeremy Corbyn's statement that he made after the Manchester attacks? He made a pretty strong statement. He basically said, "Our hearts are broken, but our resolve has never been stronger. We're determined that terrorism will not divide our communities as its perpetrators clearly intend. We are determined that the poison of terror will not be allowed to pollute our democratic politics." What do you make of this statement? And did it put him in a good light ahead of this election?
Again, a lot of this is going to depend on the media spin. I mean, the British tabloids and the British transmission media, even television and so on, is very hard to predict how they're going to spin things. But it's not going to be that friendly to him. But listen, if you listen to what he's saying, I think there's a difference between how the message will play in a working class area like Manchester. I mean, you can sort of feel Manchester coming together. But I mean, I'm very far away. I'm based in South Africa right now. But from what I can tell, looking at the news and so on, you can sort of feel this sense of solidarity, the sense of helping everyone out, regardless of class, and religious and other lines. So you can sort of feel that Manchester itself and other northern working class cities would resonate with that a lot, and that's his base. He needs those people to turn out. So I think that's going to be good for him there. Whether it works in other parts of the country, there are parts of the country that are much more, I would describe as sort of Thatcherist, in the South, that hate that kind of rhetoric, that think that solidarity is a joke, and that really, are all about free markets and capitalism and Ayn Rand and Margaret Thatcher, etc. So in those parts of the country, he may lose some support, but I don't think he had much support in those parts of the country anyway. So I think he's saying the right thing.
Well, so do you think that progressive hopes in some sort of Jeremy Corbyn-related victory might have been overblown even before Manchester, and certainly now it's not really looking very good?
No, listen, I think we have to be realistic. I should say that I've met Jeremy Corbyn. I got stuck with him. He used to come to our India-Pakistan peace events that I was involved in about 7 years ago. And I got stuck in an airport. We both missed our flights or something. I got stuck in an airport in Bombay with him for a couple of hours. And I thought he was a great guy. The first politician I talked to that I didn't feel like I had to sort of have a shower afterwards. Just as a human being, he was a nice person to talk to, right? Um, So all that said, I mean, I think that none of us had any hopes of him winning. None of us who were following the elections had any hopes of the Labour picking up enough to form a government. That's a joke. Him winning, in quotes, what that would mean was that he got more votes than his the former leader of Labour got in the last election in, I believe, 2014, right? So, which was one of the brothers, sorry, I'm blanking on the name right now, but the sort of centrist wing of the party ran, and they failed miserably, right? And so the question would be, can the left wing of the party do better? And I think that was the measure that we were going to judge him by, not a winning. The chances of Labour putting together a government without Scotland, basically all of Scotland has fed up with the Blairite Labour wing and has no longer votes Labour. So without that big base in Scotland, they vote for the SNP, the Scottish National Party. So it would be very difficult for the Labour to form a government almost ever. They might be able to do a coalition with the Scottish National Party at some later point in time. But at the moment, winning at this point is just coming close. Just giving Theresa May, not giving Theresa May what she wants. Theresa May wants super majorities so she can push through harsh legislation. Avoiding that is a victory.
Well, let's talk about US-UK relations in light of Manchester. I mean, of course, the US and UK have had a long shared a, quote, special relationship with Trump coming into power here. It, especially in the last day or two, things have gotten a little tense. Because you had U.S. media publish information that was shared between by the U.K. intelligence with the U.S., including the name of the suspected suicide bomber and photos of evidence gathered at the scene. And it's pretty unusual and really quite shocking for the UK police to announce that they have stopped sharing intelligence with the US. The US and UK have had intelligence sharing relationships that go back a very, very long time. So what does this mean? Is it an indictment of Trump, even though Trump has said he will investigate these leaks?
I think it pretty much is. I mean, I think the question is, why is it coming out? There just seems to be no professionalism here, frankly, you know? So I think that from the British point of view, whether the leaks are good or not is like a different issue, right? So whether transparency in this case is a good thing or a bad thing, let's discuss that at a separate time. But what this is showing, what the leaks from the Trump administration are showing in this particular one, which is an international security matter, and leaked almost immediately, right? Because they would have only known a couple of hours before anyway. What that shows is that I think what the British are going to say is that, okay, the White House is not to be trusted with information. They might trust other agencies. They haven't said how exactly they're revising their policy, by the way, Sonali. They just said that they are revising their policy. So what that might mean is that the White House is not to get such briefings. But there may be other people, for example, the director of the CIA, or the interim director of the FBI, maybe, I don't know, who would get such briefings. One must assume, because otherwise it would be very unprecedented to sort of break ties completely, and it's not something that the British would want to do.
Right. I mean, British politicians, one of them said that the Americans have done this is incomprehensible. Dominic Grieve, Conservative Party leader, one of the leaders said the leaks are a, quote, flagrant breach. And even Theresa May herself said she would bring it up personally with Donald Trump at the NATO summit in Brussels. I mean, you know, we can't even put this past Trump himself, who in a phone call recently with the Philippines President Duterte named the locations of submarines and has just let things slip, you know, with Russian diplomats deciding to share Israeli intelligence on the Islamic State. It's just very... He's certainly someone who doesn't seem to have much of a filter. So what do you think at this point on the issue of terrorism we're going to see between the US and UK? Because whenever you have such attacks happening in Europe, US politicians also like to make hay of it. And US politicians are extremely interested and often cite, especially, you know, people like Steve Bannon, often cite attacks in Europe as having relevance in the United States.
Sure. Before I address that one, you mentioned the conversation between Duterte and Trump. That's an interesting one, right? Because they're part of what I would call the axis of like pseudo-fascism, right? These sort of right-wing leaders, Modi, Duterte, and so on, that are coming up, Trump being one of them. But the interesting thing about that is that the Trump administration insists that the leak was from the Philippines. And if that's true, it means the incompetence is kind of across the board. It means that these new right-wing folks coming up really have no, I mean, it's not that they don't have a filter, they don't have control of their own people. They don't have a sense of how to leak things in a way that's actually beneficial for them, right? Instead of leaking things willy-nilly, right? Mm. So I'd say that's something for the left to maybe take some hope in. Maybe at least these guys are incompetent, even if they're evil. To address the
issue of how European attacks like the one in Manchester are used not just by right-wing politicians in Europe, but here in the United States as well.
Yes, absolutely. So I saw Paul Ryan on Twitter talking about how evil it is to target innocent children and so on. But the interesting thing was that the reason I saw that was because someone responded saying, it's a good thing you put hashtag Manchester, because otherwise I thought you were talking about your healthcare plan, right? So in other words, I think that domestic politics are going so badly for them at the moment that they are not going to be able to use this as a way out, especially when you have things like that leak, the leak of the Manchester documents, that so that they're not even being good hawks, right? They're not even being the good security state, right? So when you can't even play that card, you're in a pretty dire position. And I think the Trump administration is in a pretty dire position, but maybe my analysis of that is different than others. I think it's more to do with the healthcare bill, and it's more to do with the repeal of the ACA. And I think that's really going to hurt positions across the board.
And Samir, when these kinds of attacks happen in Europe and even here, to a lesser extent in the United States, obviously, any senseless death is just any death is something that's hard to make sense of. But we, of course, never hear nearly enough about the deaths happening, often as a result of our own policies in faraway countries. There was a report released showing that more Afghan children were dying in the year 2017 than in previous years. There was this, a horrific incident in Iraq in March where 100 people were killed, and the U.S. is being investigated as having been responsible, but the U.S. is now saying that it was ISIS that was responsible. I mean, the order of deaths is often so much greater in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And you just don't get that level of sympathy here in the West, particularly given that our governments are often responsible, either directly or indirectly. That just has to change.
Yeah, and I think this, let's see how the events in Manchester unfold, because I think that it will be an opportunity to discuss that. Mm-hmm. Because I think, this is speculation at this point and rumors that I've heard, but I think that the same groups that we've funded, I know that the groups that we funded to oust Gaddafi and the ones that are in power in parts of Libya are the ones who trained this person in all likelihood, right? So, Abedi. So,
and this happened while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. In fact, it was her project to have a NATO with the U.S. leadership take Gaddafi out in Libya.
Definitely. There's bipartisan evil. There's no question about it here. So this is why I think it's a time to have that discussion. If these guys can do this kind of damage in Manchester, how much damage do they do in Libya? How much damage do they do in other countries? And by the way, why are we supporting them? Why are we supporting the most fundamentalist regime in the world, the Saudis, to bomb their neighbors just because their neighbors happen to be Shia? And that's that, you know, the carnage in Yemen is pretty crazy. It's out of control. And it's hard to get good reporting because there are not many reporters there. It's not a story that gets a lot of coverage in the U.S. or in international media. But from what I can tell, it's just awful.
And
Afghanistan, Iraq.
Right. Finally, Samir, with Trump in Brussels, one of the main things that he had campaigned on and seems to be carrying out a campaign promise is basically scolding NATO officials for not paying their fair share for military activities. He has brought that up in Brussels. I don't know how that will play out, particularly in light of the Manchester attack and, you know, the sort of longstanding relationship between the US and NATO's heads of state to have these joint military exercises and you know, battlefronts. But any thoughts on the future of NATO under Trump?
Oh, that's really hard to say, isn't it? At the moment, I get the feeling that Trump must be thinking that he's a bit out of his depth in NATO, especially at this point in time after a crisis. I just get the sense that he's, and with everything going on at home and with him, you know, telling people not to investigate Russia, etc. I mean, I just get the feeling that if he doesn't feel that he's in over his head, he should. Someone should tell him he's in over his head. So anything that he says to NATO is going to be more or less ignored, because they know that he's not very serious. His budget also indicates that he's not very serious about a lot of these things. That's point one. Point two is that, you know, it's a bit of a shame, because this could have been an opportunity for all of his faults. The stance on sort of militarism and NATO and so on, it could have been an opportunity to discuss the military-industrial complex. It could have been an opportunity to discuss, you know, constant wars being promulgated around the world through NATO or through the U.S. or through other mechanisms that exist, right? But instead, we're getting sort of a very haphazard approach to the military-industrial complex, trying to boost it up, from what I can tell, but in a very disorganized way.
Right.
And selling arms and so on. I mean, it's not clear what the policy is, because it's not coherent. But whatever it is, it's not good.
Right. It's veering on contradictory, not just coherent. In January, NATO was obsolete to Trump. And in April, it was, quote, no longer obsolete. Well, we'll see how things play out. Samir, always a pleasure to have you on and have your analysis on our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest is Samir Dosani, independent activist and freelance journalist. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.